Friends, welcome back to the Ageless Athlete podcast, where we learn and be inspired by adventure sports icons. Today's guest is Catherine Dominic, a true multi-sport athlete who blends her career as a top-notch data scientist with a passion for pushing physical and mental boundaries through high-end solo adventures in wild and beautiful places. Born in Germany and a former rock climber, the 44-year-old has quickly made a name for herself with some remarkable accomplishments in kayaking and bicycling. Last year, she finished a solo kayak trip that spanned over 52 days with paddling 1,200 miles through the remote Alaskan Inside Passage. She also regularly undertakes bicycling expeditions, such as self-supported bikepacking trips across the rugged landscapes of Guatemala and Mexico. To me, what makes Catherine's feats remarkable are her thoughtful planning and her ability to learn from prior experiences and meticulously plan for any contingency. Catherine's adventures are defined by foresight, spunk, endurance, and the ability to thrive in solo wilderness environments for weeks at a time. How do you avoid getting marooned during king tides or avoid grizzlies in dense grizzly bear environments? Listen on. Hi, Catherine. I know you've been traveling a lot of late. Can you tell us where you are now? What did you have for breakfast?
Well, hey, Chris, good to see you. I just came back from Spain. I was there for family reasons. And while I was there doing some, you know, the usual cycling, kayaking, things like that. What did I have for breakfast today? You know, just coffee.
If we are in the same time zone, it's 3 o'clock and I'm having coffee right now, but that sounds like pitiful, meager rations to subsist on all day.
I can do coffee all day.
Would love to learn a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What do you do? What pulls you into the outdoors?
I moved to San Francisco in 2014. So I'm actually going to be celebrating my 10-year anniversary in the United States in San Francisco this year. At this point, this is life. This is home. I'm working as a machine learning software engineer. I work in AI research, mostly look into responsible AI application, particularly working on a project for speech recognition for people with speech impairment. So that's totally aside from my other outdoor stints.
Congratulations on your upcoming 10 years in San Francisco. I believe before San Francisco, you were living in Europe and perhaps in Germany. Would love to know a little bit about your backgrounds or your roots in Europe. Add on to that, what could be a favorite memory growing up?
Yeah, I grew up in Germany, southern Germany, close to the Black Forest. And so, you know, for us, it was kind of normal to go, not really skiing. We never went skiing as a family, but just, you know, walking up the hills and sledding down on like a piece of plastic or, you know, like a piece of cardboard with like some plastic bag wrapped around. We went, my grandfather's a hunter, and so we would often get access to these cabins, really basic cabins, you know, like one room, one wood stove, one stove to like burn wood and cook on, and would stay there for, as like a mini family vacation for 2-3 days.
That sounds bucolic. I've heard you mention that at some point you would like to have a cabin by the coast, perhaps here. So I'm wondering if there's a connection between that memory and your aspirations to be a cabin owner.
Could be. I really like the minimal setup, you know, this one room, cozy cabin. It's just warm and not much in there. A little minimalistic, just away from the fuss of a city. As much as I like city life, it's also really nice to get away.
What do you do for work? Sound light and easy peasy. No, I'm just kidding. It sounds interesting and complex. I am wondering on a topic that I was thinking about recently, thought to ask you now, which is amongst the climbing community in urban cities, sometimes you find a lot of climbers who are who have technical jobs, engineers and other kind of things. And then they also like to go adventure outside. You know, in some ways, you fit the mold. I am wondering, is there a connection somehow between the two people who have, let's say, cerebral or scientific day jobs, but also like to go chase adventures outside?
It's a good question. For me, I think that's a pretty essential balance to my otherwise, you know, chill work life in terms of I'm just sitting at a desk in a cozy, warm environment. And I feel I need to challenge myself physically and mentally on that level often enough. So maybe it's the, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's the balance. These outdoor adventures take planning and a level of responsibility, which maybe is something you could find in some jobs as well.
Yes, there's possibly a connection between the two in some ways. When I met you, we used to go climbing. At some point, you either departed from climbing slightly or you reconnected to some other sports you pursued before we met as climbers. What are the things you do in the outside today? What are your main sports?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. If you had asked me that question, what are your main sports? If you had asked me that, I don't know, 7 years ago, I would have clearly said climbing and everything else is second with like a huge gap in between. And it totally shifted now to cycling and kayaking as my main sports. And then I still like climbing and I would go occasionally, but it just moved to another, you know, it's changed in importance. And what led to that? Moving here in 2014, I was so excited to live close to Yosemite Valley, do all these famous climbs, get on it. And I mean, remember, we were really going after stuff like every weekend. Basically, my weeks were like Friday night, you drive somewhere, and then Saturday, Sunday, you keep climbing. Sunday night, you drive home. Monday night, you unpack. You know, then you have one night in the city and then you pack up again. And Friday, the pattern repeats. And I might have overdone that for like pretty much 2 years straight. And I think I got tired of that sort of rhythm, you know, and I was just looking for more local stuff. And that's where biking pretty much came in to keep me in the city and have outdoor adventures while still being in the city and having time to do other stuff on the weekend.
I enjoy that about, at least about road bicycling. I can leave home in my kit and be biking outside the door. And what about kayaking? How did that also come into your life?
You know, that's funny. That came in when my sister visited me in, I think, 2016. And we were supposed to go climbing, but she had just torn her meniscus. So she had knee issues and we couldn't really do all the climbing that we've been wanting to do. And so we just did a trip up the coast together and we rented a, you know, these like bulky sit on top kayaks, these like big things. They're super stable. And we rented one of them at the coast somewhere and just sat on it and paddled out into the waves and, you know, had a bit of fun. And that was just a day thing. And I came back and I was like, oh my God, yeah, I should totally go kayaking. This is amazing. And I used to do like a tiny bit of kayaking in college. So, you know, many, many years ago. I think it took me almost another year between this visit from my sister and then, you know, me finally getting after kayaking. But then I took classes and yeah, once I started the classes and once I really got on the water, there was no stopping.
I remember your sister's trip. And another thing I just remembered about her trip also was she and I went surfing, I believe. I remember taking her surfing once, which I think is kind of funny, given that you dabbled with surfing for a little bit, but you and I never went surfing. I don't think we have.
I tried it. Yeah.
Obviously, given all the kayaking you've been doing, kayaking seems to have been your true calling to the waves of the water. And another thing that chimes with me is those long trips to climb, the commutes from San Francisco get tiring after a while, and being able to bike, just like we spoke about, but then also be able to surf and maybe same thing with kayak with a much shorter, let's say 15, 20 minute approach, quote unquote, or drive to the water has certainly enormous appeal. Let's jump right into some of your recent trips. You know, jumping in, you just completed an epic kayaking trip through the Alaska Inside Passage. Before we get into the trip itself, we'd love to know, how did you come up with the idea and how did you prepare for it? Because you just started kayaking a few years ago, and to the outsider, it seems that something of this scale would require a lot of preparation.
Briefly, this past summer, 2023, I kayaked from Orcas Island in Washington, one of the San Juan Islands, from there all the way up to Skagway, Alaska. It's about 1,200 miles. It took me 50-something days. So yeah, quite a longer trip. And the trigger at that specific trip is that in 2021, in the pandemic, I visited friends who live on Orcas Island. with a friend. And, you know, back then with the pandemic, the borders weren't quite open. And I was kayaking in this area. And there is a border, literally like a water border between Canada and the US, which is about 15 miles literally from their house, right? So I was kayaking along and it's kind of strange to like look, you would look northwest and there's like this vast water and like system of more islands. You can see that, but you're not allowed to go. And because of the situation back then with the pandemic, and I think it was such that, how was it? Canadians could come to the US, but Americans couldn't come to Canada. There was something like that. And I was like, well, okay, I have a German passport. Could I? And everyone was like, you know, you should just not mess with that system right now because there's a lot of tension. Just don't do that, right? But I remember me sitting in my kayak. I was looking at my cell phone. I was already getting reception from Canada. You know, this is how dreams grow. You're like, damn, what if I could just... And that evening I came back, we're staying with, and I told them about that. And they're like, yeah. But you know, at some point you can. And do you know that you can go all the way to Skagway in what's called the Inside Passage? And truthfully, I've never heard about that before. And I think that night in sometime July 2021, this idea was born, you know, of doing this. Yeah, and then maybe adding to that, because eventually we can blame the pandemic for everything here. Yeah. In 19, I signed up with a friend for what's called the Yukon River Quest, which is, you know, like a long distance race down the Yukon River, which we were supposed to do in June 2020. So I bought a boat for that. I started training already in November. And, you know, we all know the pandemic hit. And I think in April, they blew off this race. And I was really disappointed because at that point, I had already trained. I had bought a boat. You know, I was really committed in doing... I had bought flights. I had rented kayaks. You know, we lost a little bit of money. And I was so frustrated, like I guess we all were in the pandemic, that I just decided to do the whole mileage, the 400-something miles we would have had to do on that race. I just do this in a month in the bay. You know, we couldn't really do much else. And so I just started this crazy paddling routine where I would kayak about 3-4 hours every day and for like a month. And I think that really got me into sustained endurance paddling. And I just realized how much I like that.
One thing I certainly pick up here is if anybody's ever looking for adventure ideas and they are in a foreign or a new place, they should look at their phone signal to see where they might be catching service and let that be the planting of a seed. The idea was birthed there. There were some other maybe smaller dreams that remained unfulfilled, and you decided to just take things to a next level and plan this big trip. Can you just give us a quick summary, Catherine, of what that trip was like? What is the Alaskan Inside Passage, and how did you end up faring?
The Inside Passage goes from Port Townsend, but you know, anywhere you could begin it in this area, San Juan Islands, northern Washington. And then it leads through a system of fjords and channels and a little bit of outside ocean, you know, on basically the north the northeastern side of Vancouver Island. It wiggles around there, and then it turns basically at Port Hardy, it turns sharp north and just follows these fjords and systems up all the way to Alaska. You're crossing the border between Prince Rupert and Ketchikan. That's basically where the U.S.-Canada border is. Then you're back in the U.S. And then from there, you can continue another 600 miles towards Juneau. And then from Juneau, you extend it into the Lynn Canal, which then ends... I mean, that literally ends. You really can't go any further in Skagway, Alaska. And obviously, you could, you know, continue elsewhere, but this is like the most logical line. And the Inside Passage is also a ferry route these days. So there is literally a what's called the Alaska Marine Highway, a ferry system running all the way from Skagway, Alaska, back to Washington. And that's been certainly one of the reasons why I did that, because this is literally a expedition by public transit. I'm a big fan of public transportation. And so basically you kayak for 52 days and then you jump on a ferry and take the ferry back.
That was badass. I believe you kept a detailed trip log in one of the online blogging sites. So we will put a link up there. People can get caught up on all the gory details. Mm-hmm. One thing certainly that stands out is I believe you put a lot of work into preparing for the trip, you know, right from obviously the physical adaptations, but also planning for weather, planning for transit connections, planning for food, planning for natural disasters that might take place. Do you enjoy that kind of planning? Because sometimes hearing you talk about it, I think I see your eyes lighting up. Is that something that comes naturally to you?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the trip, right? To like spend, you know, I spend 52 days kayaking, and I think I spent, well, at least that much, probably a little bit more like 3 months planning, preparing everything. Spent so many nights hunched over maps, sitting at a computer. I literally map all the campsites between my starting point and my end point. Like I had this huge map with like hundreds of possible campsites that I had, you know, gathered from other people, from the internet, from other sources, put them all into a map. I literally planned the whole route. I had like a spreadsheet with telling me for which day I thought I could go, how far, what the hazards would be, you know, yeah, all of that. So yeah, lots of time planning the route, lots of time training. I had like a 5 day on, 2 day off training plan. So the goal was to, you know, oftentimes when, yeah, depending on what you do, you try to get more rest days. But my goal was really to have this long endurance days and multiple of them in a row. And so to do so, I just basically trained like that. I would kayak usually Wednesday through Sunday, you know, trying to fold that into my work day. Let's say go early mornings, go at night, and then have like 2 big ones on a weekend.
And, a lot of this training happened, I'm guessing, pre-work or post-work around San Francisco?
Yeah, like a lot of, yeah, because it's so easy to train here, right? Like I can literally from my house be at the water. In my case, my closest basically put in for my kayak is in Isles Creek in San Francisco in the Dog Patch area, if you know that. And we have like a little kayaking club at this like, little beach, and I can just drive there in 15 minutes and put in and then kayak as long as I want to. So I would oftentimes do 3 hours a day on, you know, like a short work day before work, after work, and then aim for 6 to 8 hour paddles on a weekend.
Nice.
And, you know, a friend gave me 60 pounds of sandbags, and those were my training buddies. So these 60 pounds of sandbags came with me for 2 months. Every time I would kayak, I would take these 60 pounds of sandbags with me because that sort of simulated my load that I would be having.
60 pounds of sandbags. How many sandbags were these?
There was one with a different kind. So I spread it over, I think, over 4 bags. Four of these like waterproof dry bags.
Sure. Yeah. That sounds like you had calculated the kind of weight you would be carrying on the actual trip with you. Over this trip, you spent many days by yourself, and reading your trip report seemed like some of those days in your own company were some of the most fun ever. Knowing you personally, you don't come across as a recluse to me. What's appealing about solo adventuring to you?
I think it's the intensity. You know, it's like you get everything unfiltered. Because also you get 100% responsibility. It just sharpens everything. The way you look at it, the way you perceive it, the way you have to look out for problems. And then, you know, once you are done with your day of kayaking, you're sitting at the beach at night, your tent's pitched, you've had your dinner. There's nothing else to do. Maybe read a book and then you can just, I don't know, perceive your surrounding. Yeah, it's extremely beautiful. I'm not sure if fun is the right word. I mean, it's not unfun, but it's not, you know, entertaining in the way we think of fun when we think of out with friends. It's extremely beautiful.
Many people who undertake these kinds of trips often look for a companion, a friend, a buddy, somebody they can rely on, etc. Do you think your keenness to undertake these trips by yourself make you or set you apart in some way? And by the way, I totally appreciate what you said about the heightened intensity of the experience and maybe how it forces you to, you know, dig deeper and rely upon yourself and how maybe the sensations you feel are unique and incredible. But yes, wondering if this is a quality that you seek differently than others.
You know, I do. In some trips, I really want to do as a solo trip. And this one, I wanted to. Yeah. I had actually asked a couple of friends if they wanted to join for sections. And that didn't work out. That was fine. But I would not have wanted to do this trip with, like, do and plan this trip with another person. Yeah. So it was on purpose a solo trip for all of those reasons, but also to be fully in sync with myself for that long. And, you know, every day do it exactly the way I want to do it in terms of when to start in the morning, what distance to paddle, what cadence to paddle. Because again, it's an endurance sport, right? Like, you gotta like that sort of endurance setup. And I just really enjoy that physically, the sort of flow. You know, you do run, so you probably know that the flow really depends on what exactly is right for you. If you're just a little bit off, it's hard to get into this moment of flow. And I just really wanted to enjoy that flow situation. Then obviously, on the other hand, doing solo trips, you have a different margin of error, right? So you have to be more careful in many aspects. And there's, you know, there's plenty of trips that I love to do with people for the companionship, but also because that allows you to do trips that you would maybe not necessarily do solo, just from like a risk assessment perspective.
Sure. Just putting a pin on that point there, you planned meticulously for this trip and you also equipped yourself where you could with technical gear and forecasts of different kinds and a read of the hazards that you might encounter, right? And you prepared yourself. At the same time, it's quite apparent that you enjoy the purity and the intensity of the adventure. So what's that balance that you found between having things planned out on one side and versus leaving some things to chance?
Well, I mean, you know, if you are out in the ocean or in the water, there's so much you can't control, right? Like, nature is just strong force, and you'll notice that once you're in waves or if the wind's up. So that part, these elements are always there. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think that's a big part. And then I would also go on the water, maybe in not the most perfect conditions, you know, having planned that much and having trained that much, I think allowed me to go on the water. Yeah. When the conditions were just a little bit icky, but I think if you know exactly what your strengths are and, you know, what you can do safely, then this allows you to go in. Yeah. And then you're pushing the limits a little bit while still, you know, playing it safe.
And honestly, I know, I think that makes sense. As you were speaking, I was thinking to myself, given all the unpredictability that the ocean brings and being solo on a trip like this brings, you will still be leaving so much to chance and adventure, even after having planned so much of it out. One last question before we zoom out again, just for fun. What was the biggest fear you had setting out for this trip?
Oh, I was scared of these bears everywhere. There's like black bears and brown bears, basically along the largest portion of the route. And my only experience with grizzly bears so far was in Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska, where I've been in, when was it, 2017, on a one-week kayaking adventure with a friend. I think we've seen 3 or 4 grizzly bears every day. You know, there are just so many. And there were so many moments where we decided, oh yeah, let's camp here. You're looking at a beach, you turn away, and the moment you look at the beach again, oh no, let's go somewhere else because there's a grizzly bear now. So we had this over and over again for days and days. And I was just picturing that my whole stretch of the route would be like that, you know, and I would have to deal with that. And then, you know, it turned out to, I did actually not see a grizzly bear or any bear in the wilderness. I saw signs of it. I saw, you know, scratch marks and bear poop and whatnot, but luckily no bad encounters whatsoever.
Sure. One thing I remember when you were talking about this trip somewhere else is apparently at some point you encountered some animals who you thought might have been bears, but they turned out to be, to your relief, just a pack of wolves.
Yeah, I came to that island. Well, actually, I traded. I changed the route a little bit. So speaking of planning, plans are also there to be changed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so leaving, before I left from Port Hardy, I realized that I could switch up the route a little bit. And instead of going the original inside passage, which, as the name goes inside, there is like sort of a middle ground where you can basically hop on one island level further outside to the ocean. And then as you do that, you get more ocean swell, you get a little bit more exposure to wind and whatnot. but you also get away from the mainland, which gets you away from the grizzly bears. And that was a big selling point for me. So just sleeping, you know, going from island to island, like sandy beaches, and the biggest risk, well, no, I don't think the wolves were any risk, but I remember landing on the first of those islands. And, you know, whenever you land on an island, you check out the island, you look for footprints, signs of animals, and the things that I saw were footprints. And, you know, I have fairly large hands, but they were like the size of, you know, when I make a V with my index finger and my thumb, then the wolf prints would be like that hole. So pretty big. I saw them multiple days in a row, but I never saw any wolves themselves.
Got it. So you saw wolf-like prints.
Pretty sure they were wolves.
Sure, but they kept a safe distance from you as you did from them.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the pieces of safety gear that I took besides bear spray, obviously, is what's called a signal horn. And that's basically like, well, a gas-filled bottle with like a little horn on top. And you could press this button and it would make an insane horn sound really loud. And so whenever I would come to like a questionable beach like that one, I would just blow this horn, assuming that this would just scare away every animal.
Yeah, animals usually more afraid of us than we are of them. One of the things that all wildlife walk guides will tell you is if you're going in a place with wildlife you may be afraid of, is to just make a lot of sound. And then given that fortunately no bears were actually encountered, was there a point on this trip, Catherine, where you ever felt genuinely nervous or worse?
Generally nervous. You know, there were a few days when I was really pushing through bad weather. You could have taken rest days, which I just didn't feel like doing. And that would have brought me probably into a longer window of bad weather. So I decided multiple days to go early, you know, and push close to the limit where you really should get off the water. That all worked out fine. But, you know, when you see the storm coming behind you, you know, and you know, wow, we have like 2 more miles to go to make it onto this island. And I remember this Monday, the storm came a little bit earlier than I thought. Maybe it was supposed to come in at 11 a.m. And by 10, the water was already pretty messy, you know, and I could see this island ahead of me. And I'm like, wow, I'm in my last mile. I can't believe how bad the waves are getting. It's starting to be really stormy, luckily pushing me into where I wanted to go. But I saw this beach ahead of me and I'm like, oh, if I have to land on that side that's facing me, meaning that gets all the swell and all the wind, that's going to be really challenging. And then luckily I realized, given all my maps and all the planning I had done, that the landing spot was supposed to be on the backside of the island, which was perfect because I was completely wind sheltered. You know, I could basically go around the corner, and the moment you're like around the corner, you're out of the wind, you're like, oh, I can't believe it was so bad out there. So that worked out perfectly. Yeah. Would have not been great to be out there for another.
Yeah, you managed to find escape and shelter in the nick of time.
Yeah, and you know, there were like 3-4 days maybe where, yeah, I got closer to the conditions changing. And again, nothing happened, but also nothing should happen because it's just not great to be alone in such water when things go wrong.
I'm glad all ended well, and congratulations again on a great trip. Getting back to your overall sporting life, let's talk about cycling. Before I met you, I think you were doing long bike rides, but I think you picked up the intensity. And you did some trips that I looked on with a tinge bit of envy. You did this cool bikepacking trip through Guatemala recently. And then I think last year you did, I think, a really cool mountain biking trip to the center of the US. Any particular trips here that stand out where you ticked, let's say, one off the bucket list?
I feel all of them. So the trip to Guatemala I took this year with a friend, and also there was another one last year to Mexico, were the first bikepacking trips in another country, another culture, you know, where it had a huge cultural component to it. Where, I mean, cycling was still obviously a thing and it was challenging in terms of the distance and especially the amount of climbing we had to do. But it was also really interesting to be in this environment where a lot of people would tell us it's not safe, which I think is not correct. It was reasonably safe, but still like venturing out onto backcountry roads in just a very different country where you don't know exactly how things are going to be. Interestingly, as much as I have traveled in my you know, in my college years, back then mostly in Europe, other countries around this area. I've never done these trips on a bike. So biking in a completely culture and experiencing the culture that way was totally new. And it's actually great because you're way slower than, let's say, you're a backpacker and basically you are traveling with a bus going from town to town. But when you're on a bike, you just meet people more frequently. You stop at this random little corner store in like a tiny village, and just getting in touch with people was wonderful.
Yes, and you got to work on your Spanish.
I got to work on my Spanish too.
Did your Spanish get better?
I think so. It's been almost 2 weeks now that I haven't spoken Spanish. Yeah, I should get back into that.
One thing that I'm reading between long weekends climbing in the Alpine and then long kayak trips and some of these bike fests, sounds like you have an inclination for long endurance feats. Do you think that is perhaps correct? What draws you to these kinds of endurance-based adventures?
It's a good question where this is coming from. It took me a while to realize what I'm really into is these endurance things, where not only is it a full day, like, you know, multi-pitch climbing comes close to that. But as you know, in a multi-pitch route, you are climbing maybe for, you know, whatever, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, and you're not doing anything for the next 20 minutes, 40 minutes while you're belaying your body. And I just realized when I did local cycling, how much I like these like ongoing 3, 4, 5 hours, sort of nonstop or minimal stopping things. And kayaking is even more so, right? Because you don't even have any red lights. With cycling here, you still have to stop every now and then. And then kayaking is just even more. You can just keep going. And so I feel, honestly, I've maybe missed out in realizing that earlier. I remember my younger self often was like FOMO to not getting enough in every day, you know. And only later when I really got into cycling here, I realized that this sort of endurance sport was kind of missing in my life before. And it just makes me physically more happy.
How did you reach that realization? Was it feedback you got from others? Was it a coach? Was it yourself?
No, just doing it. Just, you know, luckily exploring cycling more here and then just realizing how much I like that.
I think this is one of those personality things which I am grateful for whenever those dawn on me. Many of us can spend our entire life and maybe only at the very end or never suddenly get these light bulb moments. And yes, it's not late. And you certainly, I think once you did have that learning, you have pursued that quality with vigor. Any of these trips that you have taken, whether it was risk-taking or whether it was finding your physical limits, has that happened where you felt you had gone too far?
Interesting. You know, I had this situations of type 2 fun, I think that's what we call it, more doing my climbing. And for example, I had an early experience that was actually very forming and probably very good that this happened and turned out so well. Pretty early, maybe after 2 or 3 years of climbing, where I climbed in El Choro in Spain with my partner then. We did this route called Amtrak. We started a little late. It's like a multi-pitch, maybe. I'm not even sure. It's 6 pitches, maybe. And we took everything very casual. While we weren't really good climbers, but still we took it so casual because it's Spain and, you know, and we didn't really look at the down climb at all. We just, I think we read somewhere there would be a trail and we're like, okay, that's good enough. We just hike down, right? And so we left late in the day, maybe 10 or 11 a.m. You know, it was winter, I think December or maybe end of December. It's not super cold in Spain, but can be. And so we climbed and we had some, you know, some little hiccups finding the route. And then we got to the top while it was already getting darkish, you know, and we did not find set trail. And so then we hiked down somewhere and then we wrapped down somewhere, you know, just around a tree and wrapped down into something that looked promising. And at some point it was pretty dark and we realized, wow, this is actually not going anywhere. And also we have no idea where we are. And we don't have headlamps and we have nothing with us. And we just really screwed up, you know. But we found ourselves on like a little spot that was actually like a little plateau. And I happened to have cell service. And I wanted to let our host know where we are So I called her and she immediately called the mountain police on us, or the mountain rescue, saying that it had rained the last night and there was snow maybe in the forecast. So anyways, long story short, we got rescued in a massive attempt because the policia montagna, de montagna, they had to hike over the whole mountain ridge to get us. They had to drill like a bolt and install a fixed sail, a fixed rope to come down, get us, give us a Yuma, made us go back up, you know, returned us home. We were like endlessly embarrassed. But I think this whole thing, I'm telling this in detail because I learned so much from that in terms of preparation. We talked about maybe over preparation and where's the adventure. That taught me to prepare these things. Like, it's worth to look at the descent, to look at, have a map handy, bring a headlamp, bring some sort of rescue blanket, have an extra jacket. All these things, when you head into adventures, you are responsible and yeah, you got to plan and prepare. And with this thing that we totally didn't plan and prepare and that, you know, we just got lucky that nothing happened.
Goodness gracious, that's a good story, particularly in the backlight of kayaking across Alaska by yourself versus a more pedestrian sounding sport climbing trip to Spain. And one would not expect, but it's the sweet irony that things go wrong when you least expect them to. And often the most hazardous sounding things work out well because the preparation and the anticipation allows one to succeed. When I started track climbing a dozen years ago or so, my second year of track climbing, I had a similar kind of an episode and I learned so many good lessons. And I feel in philosophy, those accidents that maybe don't leave permanent marks, those are, you know, valuable life lessons. And those can be applied to so many things. Let's see. You have already done some pretty cool trips with your sports. Any big items that are still on your list that you are planning on or dreaming of?
I have this dream which has no concrete, you know, plans yet, but I would love to kayak the coast of Greenland at some point, especially while it's still icy. And, you know, I'm scared of bears, so I'm a little bit terrified of the idea that you are in maybe polar bear country, and I'm not even sure if I can or want to handle that. So, but this is generally a region that really attracts me to go. You know, more concretely, what's sort of on my list, and I'm trying to figure out if I should attempt that soon, is basically the outer side of Vancouver Island, because at some point I turned north on my trip and I could have turned left and finished the western outer exposed side of Vancouver Island. And if I did that, I would cycle back. So what I really like is combining these different sports and avoiding shuttling. So my idea would be to kayak one half of it, have a bike stashed, and then just cycle back to retrieve my car. So that's more of a plan. You know, I'm not quite ready yet to announce a date for that, but I think this is likely to happen.
It is certainly clear that you revel in planning these kinds of trips, which for others might be logistical nightmares. But the idea of having a bike stashed out yonder that you would go on a multi-week kayak trip to get to and then bike back, well, it sounds incredible. You managed to somehow pack these long, high-maintenance, time-consuming trips alongside your busy career as a data scientist. How do you organize your life to be able to accomplish these things?
Well, for the trip to Alaska, I literally took a sabbatical, or I took 3 months off work. When you go to your manager and tell them you really have to kayak to Alaska, you need 3 months off. That got granted. I was, you know, lucky that that worked out. So far, this is the only trip that has required something like that. You know, that was also my by far the longest trip. Everything else has fit into the usual 2 week vacation scenario. And then I guess it helps to be able to work remotely. So for Guatemala, I've been working in Guatemala a few weeks remotely and then cycled 2 more weeks.
The takeaway here is don't go to your manager asking for something humdrum like a week off in Costa Rica with your family. Make sure it's extreme enough that they have no choice but to say yes.
I'll maybe ask me after I've done that two more times and I know whether that consistently works, but at this point, I think that's the strategy.
One other question about balancing your sports given again that they are resource intensive, how do you manage your cross-training between them?
You know, I actually don't train by a training plan other than, for example, I decided to have this 5 days on and off schedule, you know, and I wanted to get a decent amount of kayaking in the boat that I was targeting. So I'm not, that's basically my only training plan that I do. But I naturally like to also cycle. So that gives me a good cardio base, you know. And then these days, honestly, I'm only going to the climbing gym for time reasons. And climbing gym is so easy to do. Like you can get a really solid 2-hour workout, especially when you're going in the morning. And that's really good upper body strength. That's just helpful for so many things. So yeah, I would say what's really helpful is if you can train locally, right? And that goes to what you said earlier, cycling or surfing or whatever. It's so much easier to train kayaking locally than where we live in San Francisco than, for example, trackclimbing, where you would always have to drive somewhere.
Is the balance between these different sports, is that somehow intentional? Because let's say they use different parts of your physical capacities, maybe mental planning. Or is this somehow natural that you picked up these different sports, which allowed you to perhaps balance the demands on yourself?
It's more coincidental. It's certainly not intentional, as in I'm a kayaker and I was searching for another sport that is complementary in terms of training pattern. So in some ways, I get lucky that I like both of them, I guess. But, you know, there are certainly days when, let's say, usually kayaking is also legs and, you know, core and shoulders. It's not arms as many would assume. So, but still, a lot of core work. And depending on which sort of kayaking I do, I will choose what sort of cycling I do the next day. You know, road cycling is really mostly about legs. And then mountain biking can actually be physically demanding on your upper body and core. So after, let's say, a longer day kayaking, I don't feel great on a mountain bike. And so in that case, you know, if I want cardio workout, I would rather go on the road bike.
Do you have a coach for any of your sports? How do you know that you are doing the best you can?
I don't know.
Or let me rephrase that. Do you think you would benefit from having a coach who could help you optimize?
That's a good question. You know, I'm not optimizing for any sort of speed records. My objectives are more around an adventure that I want to do, you know, and that often involves going from A to B, doing this whole route. And so certainly I benefit from talking to a lot of people who, you know, give me feedback, give me ideas. Certainly, yes, a coach would probably not be bad, but would it be worth the effort? Because it takes time, you know. I'm not 100% sure. I'm pretty sure there's something to squeeze out, but I'm also not sure if I want to squeeze that out. Everything I do right now comes really natural and feels like exactly what I want to do. It doesn't feel so much like effort, you know, even if I go kayaking 5 days a week, that just is something I've been enjoying to do. I think the better question is, could I train more efficiently? Let's say I had a tighter schedule or less time on a date. I think that's really where this question comes in more. How can you do, because, you know, like endurance training, if you do that with endurance workout, that takes a lot of time, right? Like, could you get the same training experience with half the time? I think that's where a coach could probably help. On the other hand, for me, it's not that I'm training and not enjoying the training. For me, the training is what I want to do anyways. So again, I'm not sure if I want to cut that.
Actually, that makes sense, because what I perceive is you are still in love with the process of going out and doing the thing. And despite some impressive looking accomplishments, you are probably still peaking because you haven't been doing, let's say, kayaking for many years. So you probably are still getting a lot of return for your time in those sports. Recently, I was talking to somebody. So I started road biking a little bit more. And that person was telling me how they have a coach who looks at their Strava stats and then gives them a plan. I was like, this is great. But right now I'm only in my cycling thing and I'm sure I'm muddling my way through, but I'm still getting better. Every time I get on a bike, you know, I'm still getting better. So I probably have to wait for that point where either I start biking a lot or whatnot and I plateau and then I start getting hungry for something. So yeah, sounds like you are still
relishing the learning as you go.
Yeah.
And having fun with that.
Well, yeah, and you know, I would say when you're doing a multi-day or multi-week expedition, kayaking is just part of it, right? And it's a small part of that. Well, it's not a small part, but it's also maybe just half of the whole thing, you know. Another thing is the whole expedition logistics. It's, you know, pitching tent every night, finding your campsites, dealing with insecurities and all of that. Honestly, it doesn't really matter if you kayak half an hour faster. Mm. Like, what's way more important is that you don't exhaust yourself and the next day you're still fresh, right? So knowing what your limits are is way more important. So, you know, while not having tried a coach, and who knows, maybe they would tell me something that would really push me forward, I'm having a sense that a coach might be more important when you're doing this, where in a shorter amount of time, you're really trying to squeeze out everything. And the expedition is sort of the opposite. You're just trying not to squeeze out everything. You need, you know, you need reserves.
Katrin, how old are you?
I'm 44.
Do you find that physically you're still peaking, that you still have a lot more to give? And alongside that, I am curious if you have modified some other things about your lifestyle in order for you to keep performing. It could be things such as what you eat, how you sleep, perhaps, or other ways you spend your time.
I'm probably lucky. I would say I don't yet have to do these things, at least what you just mentioned with eating or sleeping. I would say I eat generally healthy, but I also am not overly concerned with what I eat. I'm mostly trying to not eat too much, like, you know, prepared meals. I don't like to eat out every night, but everything. And, you know, I'm like someone who eats a salad every day for lunch, just happily. In terms of one thing I have certainly, and that's just, that runs in my family. I have really bad knees, so I can't run. And also I probably wouldn't be able to climb really hard. But in general, I feel climbing really hard sport climbing, that's not particularly good for my body. I can just feel how I'm, you know, my joints are, my tendons are squeaking and my knees aren't happy with all these like crazy moves and climbing. Maybe the fact that this has been happening has pushed me a little bit more from hard climbing, you know, so maybe if that wouldn't be the case, maybe I'd be pushing harder still on sport climbing, which I don't. To your question of peaking, again, I feel endurance sport has so much, also these sort of expeditions, has so much to do with life experience also, you know, and knowing yourself and knowing your limits. And again, it's endurance. So hopefully not peaked yet.
One thing we certainly cannot change is our genetics. We get gifts from our gene pool and we get some things that we cannot change. And sounds like you have figured out things that are working well there and things which are not. What about sleep, Katrin? And one thing I remember over the years, just talking to you, sounds like you're able to get by with less sleep than others.
I am someone who is happy on 6 hours of sleep. And at this point, I've done that for, I don't know, 15 years. And I think that's my happy place, 6 hours. I've read a lot of books, and most of the books tell me that I'm sleeping too little. At this point, I feel I've done that long enough so that it's probably actually okay.
Okay. So from at least that one respect, you are a freak of nature. Any things, Katrin, that you are doing differently that have allowed you to succeed and continue at a high level where perhaps your contemporaries have not?
My strength is to some extent the planning, and that I do enjoy it. You know, I was actually asking myself whether I go in some trips overprepared. You know, reflecting on it, I do enjoy the preparation. The preparation doesn't really hurt. You can always change your plans, and it just, you know, on a solo trip, just keeps your tiny margin a little bit bigger. I think that's one of the things. For example, in Alaska trip, I came in very prepared, both in terms of route planning, but also physically. And I know that a lot of people who start that, they will just build up strength while they go, which, you know, is totally fine. And it's not that, yeah, it's totally fine. But I just like to already have all the physical preparation done in advance so I can just go.
Planning well can work wonders with me as well. And that is not one of my strongest strengths, but those few occasions when I have put in the time to prepare well with technical details, it has served me well. What could be a couple of things, Katrin, you wish you would be better at?
Well, I'm massively impatient with everything, right? You know, and while that has really good outlets, as in I can be really, really fast for example, when I'm packing and getting to go. When I'm soloing, that's fine. But I know that with friends, that's often pretty annoying when I'm standing there and I'm just so impatient and I just can't wait 5 more minutes to get something done. That would be helpful to change that.
I sometimes wish I was a bit more laid back as well, given that I generally enjoy hanging out with people who are more laid back. There is something earthy about that. Yeah, I don't know what that balance is because, yes, if I don't have expectations, then I don't get things done. And when I do have expectations, I get maybe more things done, but then I'm insufferable in some other ways. What is perhaps a failure, Catherine, that has taught you the most? It doesn't have to be like, let's say you failed at executing a sport, but just a failure in your life that you have been instructed.
That's a tough question. Maybe it's not the level of failure you mentioned or you've been interested in here, but that example I explained earlier with our climbing situation where we needed to be rescued. For me, that's not been just a little thing going bad. I perceive that as a massive failure, as in we just really screwed up, you know, and we just got so lucky that someone rescued us.
The similar thing that happened with me when I had to be rescued or my partner and I fail in some way, that's a gift that keeps on giving because I can keep drawing upon that incident and I can keep reminding myself that, yes, if I don't plan for this well, bad things might happen. Both of us have had friends who have had bad accidents in the Alpine. And I guess not directly, but I think there are also lessons from those accidents because they happen to people we know and they affected us. What I'm saying in a roundabout way is, yes, your accident taught you a lot. Mine taught me a lot. But then we also have the capacity to learn from other people's failures and apply them.
I think we both have lost people in, you know, their passions. And, you know, I'm obviously not looking at what their failure was or what specifically went wrong. But, you know, there is risk to that, right? And so I think, I mean, in some ways, a takeaway is what you do, I mean, try to do it as safe as possible, you know, and then there's always there's always something that could go wrong. I would at least like to know that I did the thing that I'm doing where something could go wrong, that is actually something I want to do. You know, I don't want to stumble into some bad situation randomly because I didn't think about it, and also in something that's not worth it because I don't care.
Given that, you know, somebody reminded me recently that I'm 45 and I'm likely at the halfway point and you're going to be 45 soon. You're younger than me. How are you preparing yourself for getting older?
Oh, wow. So I just spent 4 weeks in Spain with my parents. And actually my dad called, it was my dad's 70th birthday, and he called for basically all friends and family to join him to Spain and invited everyone. So, and I ended up staying with them for 4 weeks. So I spent 4 weeks with people in their 70s. While I've spent a lot of time with my parents before, it was interesting for me to see that and, you know, to see what it means. And everyone's pretty healthy and doing okay, but also they're 70. So there's all these little things here and there. I don't think I've thought much about getting older before that. And that certainly has triggered quite some thoughts and being aware.
Happy birthday to your dad. Sounds like you were also quite creative in finding ways to get away from your parents with long bike rides and surf kayaking at the coast.
Yeah, I mean, that's just healthy, right? You can't sit on a couch with your parents for 4 weeks.
Catherine, now what is perhaps one great gift you have given somebody recently or in the last few years? And similarly, maybe what is the best gift that you received?
Good questions. I'm trying to see if we need to, or if we want to tie that back to the adventures. I think I've inspired a few people to go on trips. I'll keep it with the adventures. I think I've inspired a few people to go on trips. Yeah. And push their limits and enjoy these trips and get into the adventures more. So encouraging people.
And perhaps one gift that you have received yourself, adventures or otherwise?
I'll stay with the adventures. What I found amazing, that's not a single gift. That's more like multiple gifts that together make this big thing. When I did prepare for my Alaska trip, I cold contacted a lot of people to ask them about their experience. And everyone responded and everyone gifted me their time, you know, as in like, sure, let's schedule a meeting. Let's talk, ask me all the questions you want to ask. And this as a community is wonderful. And obviously I would love to pass that forward. Yeah. Sharing experiences, sharing insights.
I love that about the outdoor sports community, or really love that about humans in general, of our capacity to go out of our way to help others. It always surprises me. I think when one comes from a place of humility and asks good questions, I think people respond. I find myself, and I think you as well, found yourself responding to with the same kind of willingness and generosity.
I want to tell a small story to that. Speaking of gifts, like a tiny gift that was so valuable. With our friends, Mike and Lissy, at some point, we cycled the mountains in outside of Bishop. I remember us riding up the lower part of White Mountain. And, you know, we came to this parking lot and we somehow didn't really bring much food. And so we were kind of exhausted and hungry. And this person comes by. They come by their car and looks at us. They're like, oh, wow, you guys cycled up here. That's amazing. Do you need anything? Do you need water? And we like happily took the water. And this person's like, oh, would you like some food? I have fried chicken in here. So 9,000 feet elevation, and someone is gifting us fried chicken because he thought we looked like we could use it. And we had it. It was wonderful, you know. And these little things, I feel, happen all the time when you're adventuring. Someone is, you know, someone is happy to share. Someone is happy to give you something. And those are these little gifts, but they're so valuable.
That's a good story. I know Michael loves fried chicken, so I'm sure that he was in cloud nine. I find that personally, I have a hard time asking for things. I don't know what it is. I mean, I like giving things if being asked, but I sometimes envy people who are able to both ask and receive things easily. And I think that's such a good quality to have. A different kind of fun question, Catherine. What has been the best $100 you have spent? And it could also be in euros, given that you were just in Spain.
Well, that's, I mean, we spent so many $100 here and there.
Could be $10. You don't have to stick to an exact number.
I'll take the exact amount away. But I'm amazed when I find tools that are exactly what I'm looking for. You know, and now I'm thinking of something that's more in the $600 range. But it's been like a GPS that I like to use. Or for example, I use a specific bike computer. And I love when things work really well, you know, when they exactly fulfill their purpose. So I would rather get this one thing that does exactly that than is sort of, you know, the cheaper version of something that is kind of a compromise.
Certainly. It is wondrous, the level of tech sophistication and how it allows us to pursue purity in our outdoor goals. There is a bit of a dichotomy here in some ways, but it also seems to work. We are reaching the end of our time and there's daylight. I know you will not want to waste the last bit of sunlight here. Is there something that a skill or a habit you are looking to acquire in the next few years, something you're working on to become a better version of yourself?
That patience thing goes deep. Yeah. Because it's not just about, yeah, sure, I'm just always going to be patient, you know. It's a lot about finding the right balance, as you said that earlier, between what you need and what you should give when, you know, you are somewhere with others. And so finding the right, either the right balance or, you know, the right split between when you do what's really good and important for you and, you know, when you would rather focus on others.
How are you actually working on building that habit?
I'm trying to pretty consciously make time for both more and more. And quite honestly, now that I've had this long adventure, which was really, I mean, quite honestly, that was all about doing what I need. You know, now I've had that and I know how much I've enjoyed and I know I could do that again. But now I feel I'm in a better place to step back from that a little bit.
Sure. Until Greenland comes calling.
Well, you know, but that's what I mean with the balance.
On that note, Catherine, thanks a lot for the insights and coming on the show. Hope to have you back after your trip and you can regale us with some good stories.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, lovely chatting and yeah, wonderful that you're doing this podcast. I'm stoked to see who else we're going to be hearing about soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Catherine. Talk to you soon. All right, folks. What a wild ride we have been on with Catherine today.
her insane stories about solo kayaking over 52 days across rough Alaskan waters have me feeling both exhausted and exhilarated. While the sheer physical intensity of her adventures is jaw-dropping, what really hits home is Catherine's mindset, her ability to plan for every little thing, yet still roll with her unpredictable brunches of wilderness travel. From meticulously plotting out every potential campsite, to repeatedly dodging nasty weather and lugging around 60 pounds of sandbags to simulate gear weight, her preparation borders on obsessive. But it is exactly that fierce discipline that allows her unquenchable thirst for adventures to play out safely. Perhaps Catherine's most powerful lesson is finding that sweet balance between going full send on epic outdoor feats and crushing it at her high-end tech job. By strategically bunching long wilderness voyages between hardcore work stretches, she avoids burnout while constantly resetting with nature's rejuvenating powers. Be sure to join us next time as we keep bringing you fired up tales from the front lines of athletic endurance. Until then, start dreaming up your next big wild idea. Stay adventurous and stay ageless.